Good evening, James McCanny here with my Science Hour. August 18th, 2016, tonight's main science topic, actually at the request of a number of listeners. This is an interesting story about the moon Io, it's called, of Jupiter, and it seems to lose its very, very faint atmosphere when it goes around Jupiter to the dark side, to the night side. It goes into Jupiter's shadow, and it loses its atmosphere for a few hours and then comes back. And so the standard explanations that come out of the illustrious space agency and other standard sources is really pretty hokey. And, you know, that's so common because they have so little to work with. They don't understand why it even has an atmosphere in the first place. So anyway, that's the main science topic. I'll also be talking about I don't know what these people are smoking, but anyway, NASA now claims that Venus, our sister planet to the near side of the sun from Earth, closer to the sun, next planet in the solar system, that Venus was Earth-like. That it was a planet and it had, you know, I don't know, dinosaurs? I'm not sure what they're talking about here. But they showed continents and oceans, etc. But Venus is nothing like Earth at all. It doesn't have continental shelves. It's extremely volcanic. It does not hold its shape. When the Magellan spacecraft orbited Jupiter or Venus quite a few times, in fact, hundreds of times, to map the entire planet, they had enough life in the satellite to orbit Venus repeatedly after the complete mapping of Venus. And what they saw was that the surface of Venus had completely changed. Volcanoes rise up, they drop back down into the surface in the ooze, and Venus is a very rapidly changing planet. Besides, it has an atmosphere that is about 1,000 times denser than that of Earth. And they cannot tell you where this amazing atmosphere came from, given that they claim that 3.5 billion years ago, and once again, who knows where they get this number from, that Venus was Earth-like, like with oceans and a, you know, relatively thin atmosphere, and compared to what it has today, and certainly not volcanic. And, you know, it doesn't have plates, it doesn't have any physical structure. So, at any rate, I want to talk a little bit about the real situation with Venus. Venus is simply a young planet, and they can't get over this. I'll be talking about Io, and the first thing that you'll read about Io, if you try and read some of the standard information, is that Io was formed at the same time as Jupiter, and it simply could not be true. First of all, their composition is completely different. Io, which is the nearest of the four major moons of Jupiter, Io is made primarily of iron, extremely dense. Jupiter doesn't have any iron. Jupiter has some sulfur dioxide, that's what gives it its red color, but the color of Io is based on sulfur, in iron-sulfur compounds, basically. But basically, Io has a structure, a chemical structure, completely different than that of Jupiter. So to imagine that they formed at the same time or of the same material is ludicrous. But they're stuck with that story, and apparently they're sticking to it. The issue with Venus is, and Io, is that these were formed at different times. Every object in the solar system was formed at different times except for Jupiter and the Sun. The real story of the solar system is that it formed by capture. So all of the other planets, literally, at one time or another, and a lot more, that really didn't make it as planets into this beautifully structured system that we see today, But the majority of the planets, like I say, except for Jupiter, literally, was the only planet that formed with the Sun, and it's really not a planet. Jupiter, as I've given many lectures, is a small star, and I say it's an unlit star, meaning that it is not visible. It doesn't shine in the visible spectrum, but it is radiating very heavily in the infrared. So if you look at Jupiter, and I had some pictures on my webpage showing Jupiter in the what they call thermal image, and it shows Jupiter to be very radiant in the infrared. It's like if you took your iron that you iron clothes, you plug it in, you heat it up, you put it on your ironing board, and it looks just the same to you, but to infrared, an infrared camera, you would see that bottom plate glowing very brightly in the infrared, and that's the same with Jupiter. It's very bright in the infrared, which means it has a high thermal output, but it's not constant over the whole surface. It has a central band around the equator, and then the Great Red Spot is highly active, very hot down in the center. Anyway, I talked about that a few shows ago. But the reason Io, first inner moon of Jupiter, and Venus are very similar is because they're relatively recent adoptions into the solar system. They're new planets. And my point was that all of the planets, including Earth, Venus, Mercury, Mars, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, and Pluto, and about 100 more now that they have discovered, all are recent adoptions into the solar system, and this process is called capture. It's something I studied and categorized in my very early work back in the 1970s, and of course that was the basis for the understanding that solar systems form by capture. So literally every planet in its history at one time you could have called Planet X. Planet X meaning a solar system object that had not yet been named. That's what the X is for, and it's actually an astronomical designation. And what that really means is it has not been named yet. So in terms of the solar system, as the new planets came in, they literally would have been, in a sense, unnamed or strangers to the solar system. Earth's inner core is very high in iron. So that means that it spent a lot of time in the very inner solar system near the Sun, because that's where the iron is. There's a high concentration of iron near the Sun. So Io also had to have spent a good deal of time close to the Sun in its formative years. And how does it then get out by Jupiter? Well, it does that because if you remember when I talked about comet orbits, and that's the indication that Io was a comet in the state of formation, and the orbit brings it in close to the Sun, and then it sweeps out very far in the solar system, and then it sweeps in around the Sun again, and that's what the Earth did. At some point in its life, and I suspect most of this was controlled by Jupiter, the planets then interact with Jupiter, and it perturbs their orbits into prograde orbits, because Jupiter is the dominant member of the solar system. Its orbit goes in the direction that was chosen by Jupiter when it formed, so all of the planets end up going in that direction. If, and this is in my very early work also, I recognize that if a planet is forming and tries to go in the opposite direction, it does not last very long. It's simply the factors work against it. It's going to be thrown out of the solar system by an interaction with one of the other planets, or it's going to collide with them, or there's going to be something bad that happens to that planet. It's not going to exist for a long period of time, moving in what we call a retrograde orbit or a backwards orbit. So Io spent a good deal of time in its orbit near the Sun picking up that iron. And then as it moved out in the solar system, it had, every time it came out, it had a chance to interact with Jupiter. And so these are all controlled by the gravity, the gravitational field of Jupiter. But now remember that the comets are electrical. The plasma discharge comet model means that these comets are discharging the solar capacitor and their orbits are being changed continually because of the tail drag, the drag of the tail on that comet as it's orbiting the sun. So Earth very much is an iron planet. Io is very much an iron planet. Venus, our nearest neighbor, literally to the inside of us, closer to the sun, is not an iron planet. Venus spent most of its time in the outer solar system, or between Jupiter and where Venus is today. Venus did not spend a lot of time in its comet orbit near the sun, and we know this also from the ancients. What happened with Venus is it was captured by Venus was captured by Jupiter. And that was one of Velikovsky's big mistakes, is he thought that Venus came out of Jupiter, because that's literally what the ancients thought they saw. They saw the brightening of the comet Venus as it emerged from the region around Jupiter. So they thought it was born of Jupiter. That's the mythological tale, Venus being born of Jupiter. But Velikovsky made the scientific mistake of thinking that Venus, the comet, literally popped out of Jupiter. And you could see that in 1950, where he might imagine that. But because really they didn't have a lot of what you'd call advanced scientific information in 1950 when he wrote Worlds in Collision. But literally, Venus was captured by Jupiter. It moved through the solar system already in a prograde orbit. It interacted with Mars, remember, took away Mars' atmosphere and oceans, leaving the red hulk dry planet that we see today. And then it encountered Earth on two occasions. That tells us that the orbit of Venus was already in the plane of the planets. And so Venus is working its way first past Mars, then past Earth, and then it starts cycling in with the orbital. I talked about this a couple of shows ago. It's also in my books. Describes how the tail drag circularizes the orbit, and it's called eccentricity damping and energy reduction, if you remember it from a few weeks ago lecture. And that causes the orbit of the newly forming planet, which is in the form of a comet, to cycle in, to spiral in, and then Venus became the planet we see today. That's why it has a massive, massive atmosphere. It has a very heavy carbon dioxide atmosphere. And it's molten. The surface of Venus is molten. So back to this comment, NASA has to come out with something, and they have literally no reason for saying that Venus was Earth-like 3.5 billion years ago. And I mean, where do they come up with this date? It is just so bogus, but it just shows how ridiculous standard science has become today. They can say anything unsubstantiated. No reason for saying it. Just pull it out of the rabbit's hat, throw it in, and published, mind you, published in a so-called respectable peer-reviewed journal. Excuse me for laughing, but it is funny. Yeah, the journal, by the way, was the Geophysical Research Letters. And like I say, the situation with Venus is very clear. We have a lot of information to corroborate the story that Venus was a comet, corroborating my science. And by the way, when I developed my theoretical work dealing with comets, etc., I did not set out to, say, prove Velikovsky or anything like that. I didn't even know who Velikovsky was in the years that I was developing my work. And I only found out later when a friend of mine told me that, hey, what I was talking about, my theoretical work, sounded like Velikovsky's story. So then I started looking into Velikovsky. And only at that point did I realize that I had stepped into a hornet's nest when I was at Cornell. I really never knew at Cornell why there was so much animosity towards me in my work. Now, you know, later I found out sometimes you're in the middle of a hornet's nest and you don't really know why it's a hornet's nest. But that's what happened. And so my theoretical work on comets and the description of how they're captured and the tail drag causes them to circularize their orbit and become planets. And the once they become circularized in circular orbits, the tail goes away because the discharge of the solar capacitor is much less for circular orbits than, you know. So all of this was done before I ever even knew who Velikovsky was. And that was the big shock for me, that once I started reading Velikovsky, I thought, my goodness, this guy is corroborating everything I said. In fact, that was the same phenomena that happened when I got the Colbran into my hands. And it started talking about the sky monsters and the various things that happened to Earth. Just another corroboration that of this entire history of man. And by the way, Velikovsky never knew about the Colbran. It would have been an ideal book for him, but he never knew about the Colbran, which was kept in hiding basically for thousands of years through groups throughout history, and then ultimately with the Chaldean Trust that gave the copy to me to interpret what it said. And that's where my book, by the way, Atlantis to Tesla, The Colbran Connection, came from. But anyway, the reason I'm talking, going kind of jumping back between Io, moon of Jupiter, Venus, the planet, is because they're very recent, they're both very recent, and they both are very indicative of new planets. And of course, a moon is literally a planet that happens to be orbiting another planet, or in the case of Io, a small star called that we call Jupiter. But they're both extremely hot volcanic bodies. Venus, if we could see the surface of Venus, you might say Venus is much more volcanic than Io. Io is classified as the most volcanic body in the solar system. But let me just take a little short sojourn into this issue of Io losing its atmosphere when it goes around the dark side of Jupiter, when it goes into Jupiter's shadow. And what you're really going to find, that it's not really the darkness that is causing Io to lose its very super faint atmosphere. In fact, they say that the atmosphere of Io is 1/1,000,000th the density of that of Earth, but it's primarily on Io, the atmosphere is sulfur dioxide, which is a very common chemical in the region around Jupiter. That's where Jupiter gets its orange color. That's where Io gets its orange color, is from sulfur dioxide. That's very common. And remember the comet Schumacher-Levy 9, I've talked about this many times, the mid-1990s came in to the backside of Jupiter, and they were Schumacher-Levy 9 divided into 21 pieces. So here you have 21 water comets out there in the solar system. As they start to move in towards Jupiter, as they get in close, they turn into sulfur dioxide comets. And of course, standard science can't explain that, why all of a sudden they magically turn into sulfur dioxide comets. And what the reason is, because the comet's tail is adapted from the local material in the solar system, and sulfur dioxide is common around Jupiter. So you see how many contradictions there are in standard science. It can't explain anything. My work explains all of this very easily and very naturally. Okay, but Io, okay, is literally a comet. It is still a comet. It's in the solar wind. And when it goes around behind Jupiter, it loses contact with the solar wind. So it literally stops becoming a comet. It loses its charge. And so the atmosphere that you see around Io when it is out in the solar light, so to speak, has nothing to do with the solar light or heating. You have to remember the solar energy hitting Jupiter out at that distance from the sun. When we look at our sun, it's that kind of yellow ball up in the sky. When you look at the sun at Jupiter, it looks like kind of like a big star. It would look like maybe something about the size of, let me just make a real estimate here. It would look like a couple times the size of Jupiter. So when you look up in the night sky and you see Jupiter, it's a fairly big looking, it would look like a large star, or it's actually a planet, of course. But that's just a little bit bigger than that is what the sun would look like at Jupiter. So it's not like you're getting a boatload of solar heating out at Jupiter. So the solar heating is a minimal effect. And that's why, once again, standard astronomy, they typically throw these ideas out there that it's due to Io going behind the Jupiter in the shadow of Jupiter, and therefore the solar heating is not going on. And then when it comes around, the sulfur dioxide ice turns back to gas and forms the atmosphere. It's pretty ludicrous, actually. But the other situation is, well, there's a lot of factors here. I'm not going to go into all of them. But literally what's going on is that Io, like all the moons of Jupiter, is acting as a comet. The other reason we know Io is acting as a comet, it is because it has a continual electrical discharge connecting it to Jupiter. It's at the poles. You can actually see these little auroral buttons near the North Pole and the South Pole of Jupiter, and the Voyager spacecraft detected the current sheet between Io and those two auroral points. And so you can see, as Io goes around Jupiter, you can see the auroral spots up at the north, near the North Pole of Jupiter and near the South Pole of Jupiter, and they look like horns. Now, I talked about this a couple of weeks ago, and I likened it to the term of the ancients called the horns of the bull, and it's a plasma effect of the plasma discharge comet model in large comets. And it's like a plasma-like structure that comes out of the sunward side of the comet, and it looks like, literally like the horns of a bull, and that's where the biblical references come from when we're talking about the horns of a bull. So at any rate, Io is electrically connected to Jupiter because Io is a comet. Io is discharging the solar capacitor, and so as Io becomes electrically charged, it discharges to Jupiter because and as it goes around Jupiter. But as it goes around to the night side of Jupiter, like I said, it falls out of the solar wind. So the comet activity of Io slows down. The sulfur dioxide that you see in the atmosphere is ionized sulfur dioxide, and that's the protective Debye shielding. Debye shielding is electrical shielding that happens around any comet nucleus, and the heavier ions, such as sulfur dioxide, would form a smaller shield. I'm sure that when we have better equipment, possibly, I don't think Juno has the right equipment that is orbiting the new satellite at Jupiter, but someday we will see the hydrogen cloud that surrounds Io also. And so that would be a research project for possibly somebody that's a young kid today. When you grow up, start looking for that hydrogen ionized hydrogen cloud that surrounds Io, once again proving that it is charged, that it is a comet, and that is acting as a comet as it orbits Jupiter. So it literally, once again, what's going on with Io is that it loses its charging ability when it goes around to the dark side of Jupiter because it's moving out of the solar wind. We see the same thing going on with Earth's moon. And this is one, when I talk about my weather work, this is one of the primary factors in predicting weather, is when the new moon of Earth's new moon, is 2 days after the new moon. That's what I call new moon passing, 2 days after the new moon. The new moon is between us and the sun, and it's way, way out beyond our geomagnetic field and plasma magnetic field. The moon's sodium tail is caused by the fact that the moon, our moon, is acting like a comet also. And of course, the tail, the sodium tail of the moon, is exactly like a comet tail. We have a lot of sodium in our local region of the solar system. A high percentage of the content of Earth is sodium. I don't know if you know that. The moon's composition, it has a high percentage of sodium and it has an influx of sodium that's occurring all the time. So sodium is like sulfur, and sulfur dioxide is a component, a chemical component, out around Jupiter. Then the around Earth, there's more sodium. And this goes back to the fact, and I talked about this before. In fact, a listener wrote in, I just glanced at an email, and I love emails. I wish I could read more of your emails. But a listener noticed this, and he said, could you liken it to a rainbow? That was this listener's analogy. And what I liken it to is a centrifuge, not really a rainbow. A rainbow is a differentiation of color in light, and it comes through a prism like either glass or water or something like that, and that's what splits the rainbow into its color. It's kind of a prism effect, but what's going on in the solar system is more like a centrifuge. Say you go into the doctor and they take blood. They take a blood sample, they put it in a test tube, and they put it in a centrifuge. And it spins it around, and the more dense materials in your cell material, etc., in your blood goes down to the base of the tube, which is out farther. That's where the greatest force is. And then the lighter material is the next layer, and then the lighter material yet is the next layer, and so on. So what it does is it differentiates the materials based on their composition and density. That's what a centrifuge does. Now, if you look in the solar system, the solar wind does the same thing with the chemistry of the gases and dust, etc., that's out in the solar system. The dust particles, the solar wind can push on and push on and push on until they're out at a region which I call the nebular ion cloud, which is a donut-shaped dust cloud that surrounds our solar system. It has been seen. It's been seen by other around other stars. We see this comet characteristic of stars. And that's where comet tail material can come from. But interspersed in the solar system, like I was talking about earlier, iron is near the sun. Why? Because the solar wind has a very hard time pushing on iron and getting it out of there. As you come out in the solar system, you come out the denser and denser chemicals you will find in the solar system, and then the hydrogen and the oxygen, the atoms, etc., are interspersed out there also. So what you have in the solar system is a mixture of super, super fine vapor. I mean, you wouldn't even call it vapor. It's just interspersed with atomic material. And that is what combines when the carbons and the oxygens form the hydrocarbons in the comet tail. The hydrogen and the oxygen forms water. The sulfur and the oxygen forms sulfur dioxide, and that's very common around Jupiter. The sodium and the other, like sodium chloride, is very common around Earth. Chloride is the most common element in planet Earth. I don't know if you know that. And so it would make sense that sodium chloride, salt, is a very common element that we find on planet Earth and in the oceans. But it's constantly falling in. It's constantly coming in because Earth likewise is discharging the solar capacitor. And our moon, now let's compare our moon to Io. Io is continually pulling in sulfur dioxide in its comet tail, and that's why Io has what they call a torus. It's a donut-shaped ring of sulfur dioxide that is in orbit, the same orbit as Io around Jupiter, but it's the comet tail that's trying to catch up to Io. And a lot of the standard science says that the sulfur dioxide comes off of Io. Well, that's ridiculous because it wouldn't last there very long if it were coming off of Io. Io has volcanoes. The majority of that material actually ends up right back on the surface of Io because it falls back down. It has an initial velocity to get up to a couple hundred kilometers max. Most of it does not ever get up to 200 kilometers max distance from Io, but it just falls right back down to the surface of Io. And you can see this around the volcanoes. They have a ring of material. So the vast majority of material coming out of the volcanoes of Io just fall back down to the surface. But the Io is extremely hot. It's volcanic like Venus because it's a new member of the solar system. Very simple. All of the other moons of Jupiter are literally frozen. They have a high water content. Io does not have any water content at all. Why? Because it's super hot. It couldn't maintain. Water is too volatile an element to be maintained at Io. So, the end result, when you look at all the properties of Io, you can explain all of them because it is basically acting as a comet. Very simple. Plasma discharge comet model. And standard science has to find some kludge answer for everything they see. They're trying to explain why this atmosphere even exists at Io because of some gravitational effect. That's what they're actually looking for. But there again, these are all electrical effects, and they're very recognizable as electrical effects once you understand how the plasma discharge comet model works. So now back to the listener's original question. I've said it quite a few times, but very simply, when Io goes around into the night side of Jupiter, it loses its electrical connection because it's no longer in the solar wind. It's no longer discharging the solar capacitor. The atmosphere, what they're calling atmosphere of Io, is really not an atmosphere. It's the divide protection sheet that forms from the infalling material. And it's just the way it is. It's a positively ionized sheath of sulfur dioxide that forms around Io as part of the comet. It's one of the standard properties of the plasma discharge comet model. And so as it goes around into what we call the dark side or the shadow of Jupiter, it also is losing the connection with the solar wind, the discharge of the solar capacitor, and the Debye shield, the sulfur dioxide shield, just vaporizes. It goes away. And so the Io is literally building up continually more material of sulfur dioxide. So how is Earth, our moon, Venus, and Io related? They're all discharging the solar capacitor in different capacities. Venus is a very young planet. Io is a very young planet. Volcanic down to the core. Here's a very interesting thing. Standard science, from the very beginning, back in the Voyager days, I was at Cornell when this theory came out of NASA, when they first discovered that Io was extremely hot. They said, well, what could be causing Io to be hot? All the rest of the moons are cold. So somebody came up with the idea, and this is one of these in the data room after this, in the data session at the late afternoon, back in the science lab or the space science lab up at Cornell. I was there when this happened. And some guy goes, oh, well, that could be due to tidal heating. Tidal heating was one of the more famous magic rabbits to pull out of the hat back then. He said, tidal heating. Well, and that immediately became the standard pat answer until someone said, hey, wait a minute. If tidal heating is the cause of the high heat of Io, then you would expect to find all the volcanoes near the equator. But all the volcanoes that you see on Io are up at the poles, at the north and the south pole, not at the equator where the so-called gravitational pulsing would occur. So that is not explained by their little theory. So they couldn't figure out how the volcanoes ended up at the poles of Io when all of the so-called gravitational differential pulsing of Io would be at the equator. So right out of the chute, it didn't work, but that is the standard story. So whenever you see these articles of standard science or from NASA, whether it's in this article on Io was in the Washington Post, they're always looking for the solution. And they think it's related to gravity. They'll always say that. They'll put it in there to make sure that nobody ever thinks about an electrical answer. and then move on. And of course, they need 5 new spacecraft to go out and prove their so-called theoretical concept. Now, just for fun and games here, I'm going to read what is on the website that is called space.com, and this is a supposed fun fact sheet about the moon Io of Jupiter. And so I'm going to read through some of these and then make some commentary on them. These are the so-called standard theories, and I just got done talking about the idea that gravitational pulsing creates the high heat. And here it is, repeated right here. It says, the volcanic activity is a result of Io being stretched and squeezed as it orbits Jupiter. Then they go on to talk about that. But, like I say, all of these concepts have severe problems. Then it says, because of the volcanic activity, the atmosphere constantly contains mostly sulfur dioxide. Well, what does that have to do with sulfur dioxide? It doesn't have anything to do with sulfur dioxide. Then it says, Io's orbit cuts across Jupiter's powerful magnetic lines of force, turning it into an electrical generator as Jupiter rotates. This is so absurd, because in outer space, plasma is not contained in a wire. So the reason induction works to generate for an electrical generator is because you move a wire, which is traps the charge carriers into a conductor. And that is the sole reason why you can have a generator in a magnetic field. In the plasma environment of outer space, plasmas are not contained in wires. Therefore, the idea of creating an electric generator in outer space does not work. But they repeat it as if it does. And this goes on and on because they don't know where magnetic fields come from. To them, they just exist. Or in this case, but you see how distorted standard science is. And here's the problem. The majority of, first of all, the reporters don't have any scientific education at all. They just repeat what NASA tells them, so they can't ask an intelligent question like, how can you have an electrical generator when there's no containment of current in a wire? You know, it doesn't occur to them. But worse, the scientists, and this I discovered when I worked around NASA scientists, is that most of them have very poor physics backgrounds. They went to school, they took physics or chemistry up to a certain point, and then that was it as undergraduates. And then they went off into Never Never Land, space science land, where they learned a lot of incorrect scientific theories and then continue to repeat them. So that's a huge problem. So these theories get into so-called peer-reviewed journals, and that's where they stay, and nobody can talk or question them. Now, another reason that the concept that Io's volcanism is caused by this gravitational pulsing, and I'll explain that in just a minute. Another reason why it can't be true is because Io is in a sink. It's in a phase lock with Jupiter where it shows the same side to Jupiter all the time. And this is common of moons, especially if they're close to a planet, like our moon. When you look at our moon, Earth's moon, you see the same side all the time. And that's because it's a tidal process. I'm not going to go into all the details of how it works. But it's very common for moons, especially close moons, to move into a tidal lock where they have one side that always shows itself to Jupiter. And so the result is that Jupiter is very round. Io is very much in the equatorial plane going in its orbit around Jupiter. So nothing changes. There is a slight elliptical orbit, which also proves that Io is a young moon, because it's in an elliptical orbit, not a perfectly circular orbit. If it had been around Jupiter for any length of time, it would be in a perfectly, perfectly, perfectly circular orbit. It's not. The elliptical orbit of Io indicates that it is recent. and it's trying to work into a circular orbit around Jupiter. That's because of the tail drag. But the fact that Io always points the same side to Jupiter tells you that the differential force on one side compared to the other is constant. So it's not pulsing. It's not some kind of constant pulsing that's going on. Now, compare, let me just explain this a little bit with Earth. Earth spins on its axis once every 24 hours. So relative, if you were standing on our moon looking at Earth, you would see the Earth rotating in a 24-hour period, and then you'd see the same side of the Earth again. And what that causes is a tide on Earth. Literally, the oceans can bulge out as much as 15 feet in the tide in the high areas like the Bay of Fundy. At the equator, the tides are not so exaggerated, but still they're very visible, that the tide goes out and the tide comes back in, and that's due to the moon. That's due to the fact that Earth is moving, rotating on its axis under the moon. And so why is that caused? Because the moon's gravitational field on the close side of Earth is stronger, therefore it pulls the ocean, which is a fluid, pulls it out. On the far side of Earth, the gravitational field of the moon is less, so the surface of the water bulges out because it's not connected to the Earth like a solid would be. Actually, the surface of the Earth actually has about a 1-inch tide that you really don't notice. But once a day, twice a day, the Earth will actually bulge out and then collapse in about 1 inch. So, okay, that's because we are rotating relative to our moon. Io is not rotating relative to Jupiter. And although Jupiter is spinning on its axis, it's not changing shape. And that's the issue gravitationally, that if Jupiter were somehow pulsing and changing shape, then you might say, okay, well, that would be a change in the gravitational field at Io. But that's not the case. So the two factors that would allow Io to somehow have a differential force, this force that's greater on one side on the near side and less on the far side, it doesn't happen at Io. So the basis for that original claim that the volcanism of Io is due to gravitational pulsing is fabricated. It's incorrect. It doesn't have any scientific validity at all. Yet you find it published in articles like space.com. I'm sure you'd find it in, you know, the standard disinformation. Wikipedia is a total disinformation when it comes to scientific material. A lot of their other historical material and just a lot of material has been cleansed and homogenized and blended for Wikipedia. So don't go to Wikipedia. Don't go to YouTube. Those are sources that are just totally unreliable when it comes to scientific information. So anyway, you have to find a new reason for Io to be volcanic. Number one, it's young. The heat of formation during the comet process is enormous. Number two, when the electrical discharge is occurring in the large comets, the kind that would form a planet like Io or the planet like Venus, that electrical charge, that electrical current is capable, because of the high energies, it is capable of nucleosynthesis. In other words, it can produce heavy elements like uranium, etc., which would then provide heat, and especially in a planet like Earth, we have a significant quantity of radioactive nucleotides in the Earth, and as those decay, that provides an element of heat to Earth besides the solar heating that we are continually getting. But we know that. How do we know that? Because helium is coming out of the Earth. Where does helium come from? It comes from the radioactive decay of heavy nuclear elements in the Earth. That's where helium comes from. That's why it's trapped in caves. That's why it's trapped in caverns in the Earth or big open areas in Earth. That's where you get helium from. and it's a limited commodity. So that's why we don't have, say, for example, helium dirigibles flying around. That's why they used hydrogen for the Zeppelin, for example. The hydrogen was a much more accessible gas, but has a little problem. It's kind of highly flammable, so not a good thing to be riding on. But at any rate, these are all facts that are very readily explainable from the plasma discharge comet model, which explains how planets form. They form from large comets. Io is still in an elliptical orbit around Jupiter. It's trying to circularize its orbit, and that is part of the tail drag process. And so, anyway, that will, I'm sure that over the, if people in 1,000 or 10,000 years are able to measure the orbit of Io, they're going to find that it has circularized from what it is today, possibly not even that long. But that's why I do these lectures also, is for posterity, because in the future, people will be able to listen to these and actually do experiments, like I'm saying. Right now, it's very difficult to detect the sulfur dioxide shield around Io. That's something that just was done, but it was done with Earth-based equipment, not with a satellite that was orbiting Jupiter, but with Earth-based equipment. Okay, everybody. Now, I've been talking about these specific cases, Venus, Io, Earth's moon. There's a lot of speculation as to where Earth's moon came from. And in the capture world environment of the universe of the solar system, let me just start with the standard story, is that something came and hit Earth, and then the moon popped out, and something like that. Well, let me explain something. When those kind of things happen, say a collision of that magnitude, it's not going to be this nice little blob of goo that just moves over and forms the moon. It's going to blow out in smithereens into a million little pieces and not form the moon. So the scenarios that you see, the textbook scenarios of somehow the moon forming from Earth or a little piece of this moves off, I mean, it's just fanciful fairy tales. That's the best thing you can say about it. With the capture process, the Earth's moon could have been here first, and Earth came afterwards. It's just that they blended into the same orbit and started orbiting one another. And, of course, there's no way of really knowing. Maybe someday we'll develop techniques to measure. But the standard technique today of determining the age of the solar system and the members of the solar system is they pick up a rock on the surface and they try and do some measurement techniques, radiocarbon dating, or the other radioactive dating methods that use combinations of or ratios of different types of radioactive elements. And those are based on assumptions. And so there's all kinds of controversy about the dating techniques. But it doesn't even matter, because what's on the surface has nothing, I repeat, what is on the surface of a planet, Earth or Moon or wherever, it has absolutely nothing to do with the formative materials of the planet or Moon. You have to get down deep into the core. Look at, we're already drilling down 18 kilometers into the Earth, and we're finding beach sand. We're finding oil that was created on the surface. We're finding trees that are way, way down there. So the Earth, anything near the surface, has nothing to do with the formative process of the Earth. Let's just get that straight. Although you will find that in all the textbooks, like I said, if you want to get an education, don't go to school. That's where you get 12 or 16 or 20 years, however long you go, filled with complete nonsense that couldn't possibly be true. So the age of the Earth would be very difficult to tell and actually determine. Maybe we'll meet some aliens someday that have a history that goes back millions of years, and they'll say, you know, so many, you know, billions of years ago, this is what your solar system looked like, and this is how the Earth came in. Maybe they even have some video footage of Earth being a comet, being adapted into the solar system, and reducing its orbit, having its orbit reduced into a beautiful circular orbit, and then combining orbits with the moon. Or maybe Earth was here first and the moon came second. Who knows? It's not something you can tell simply by, say, just because of the fact that the moon is smaller doesn't mean it had to come second. It could have been here before Earth because of the way the capture process works. Okay, so anyway, I want to go through a little bit of a scenario here and talk about comet capture. And this is what happened with Venus. Venus is a great example. I think it's in the appendix of my Atlantis to Tesla, the Colburn Connection book. I think it's in that book, but one of the appendices where I have a something that I wrote back in the 1980s, literally. It was called From Exodus to Voyager 1, the Velikovsky Connection. And you could see I was already building that title type back then. It was called, and it's, look for that in the appendices of one of my books. But it's a great narrative of Venus becoming a planet. It comes in, it's captured by Jupiter, and then it goes through the whole scenario. But capture, let me explain something about capture. You need, in celestial mechanics, which is the study, the analytics of planets or other objects moving in the gravitational fields of other objects. When you're in rotational dynamics, things don't work the same as when you are not in rotational dynamics. The planets are in rotational dynamics. So it takes two gravitational objects to capture a third one. And the typical scenario is where the third object is much smaller than either of the original two. That's why Jupiter and the Sun were the capturing members, the original members of our solar system. And there's a little problem in celestial mechanics. The Russian mathematicians did a lot of work on this in the early days when mathematicians and physicists worked close hand in hand and actually understood how celestial mechanics works. They did a study on what they call the n-body problem, and they realized that if you took just random motions of objects and threw them together, random velocities, random directions, etc. Like, say you took our nine planets that are in the solar system and you brought them in at all different directions and velocities, most of them wouldn't remain very long at all. Most of them would be ejected out of the system, and the dominant member, as you might imagine, would be the big guy, Jupiter. And so the organization of a solar system is controlled by the biggest member, which is Jupiter. If you came into the solar system and you were an alien and you wanted to spec out a chart of the solar system and all the orbits and all the objects in the solar system, you would use Jupiter as the baseline and not Earth. And because we're Earthlings and we live on Earth, our solar system and our definition of the sky is based on the rotation of the Earth, the celestial clock, the star clock, sidereal clock, and sun time, etc. And so our clock, our hours, the day is divided into 24 hours. Star time is different than sun time, etc. Okay, but at any rate, the big guy, which is Jupiter in the solar system, the big planet, or the big secondary object, I should say, because Jupiter is a star, is the one that does the bulk of the capturing and the organization of the solar system. The entire direction of the solar system in the capture model is dominated by the biggest member, which is Jupiter. So that's why we all move in the same direction. This idea that everything formed from a collapsing dust cloud is ludicrous. It simply doesn't work because all the planets would spin backwards. I know there's so many problems with it that it's not even worth talking about. Capture is the method of formation of solar systems, and I realize this. Can you imagine 1979? We are approaching the 40th year celebration of my work at Cornell. the actual discovery of these principles, we're already hitting 40 years. But look at the resistance of the standard scientific community over those 40 years. The inability to get a word in edgewise, and the ridiculous fairy tale theories that have been able to sustain over that 40-year period. It's absurd. Okay, but at any rate, let's take an object that comes into the solar system, just a rock, whatever. It is captured by maybe Saturn and the Sun. That's the two-party system that is capturing that particular object. Or it could be Neptune and the Sun, but Jupiter is the dominant member. Once it's captured into the solar system, if it's in a prograde orbit, now it has a chance. If it's in a retrograde orbit, something's going to give. Something bad is going to happen before that member is either thrown out, or it collides, or it has a serious gravitational encounter with another member of the solar system. The discharge of the solar capacitor, the changing of its orbit by perturbations with the other planets, and then the tail drag. And then the building up of the object, if it's large enough to maintain the matter. Very, very few of these become planets. And you can see that over the long history of our solar system, we only have nine major planets. There's hundreds of them out there in the Kuiper Belt, which are small minor planets, but only nine major planets. And that's so statistically, becoming a planet is very rare. So the fact that we have one planet Venus, which was created in historical times, is a very rare event. And so it's given us a clue on how the solar systems form. And standard science, of course, does not follow that lead. I follow that lead because I consider what the ancients tell us real data. The fact that electrical discharges occur between planets and comets, very real. That's what the Tunguska event was in Russia, and on and on. So this, I hope, answers the question of a number of listeners regarding Io so-called losing its atmosphere. Remember to go to the webpage, jmccsci.com. And remember, I also have what I call the paid cast, $3.95 per month. You get every week I put out a new paid cast. This week's title is, let me read it, Radiation and You, Part 1, Modern Life in a Radiation-Toxic World, with a special announcement regarding a fire in Washington State that released enormous amounts of radiation into the atmosphere, and that was in early August. So I have a special report on that in the paid cast for this week. Go to the webpage, sign up for that, and that also helps support all the things that I do on a monthly basis. Once again, the webpage, jmccsci.com. If you purchase more than $100 worth of products on the sales page, you get the first month of the paid cast free. If you purchase more than $300 on the sales page, you get 6 months free of the paid cast. Plus, there's a big red letter sale on right now. Visit the webpage, jmccsci.com. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.